You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In 1999, tens of thousands of people gathered in Seattle to protest the World Trade Organization Summit. These gatherings have since become known as convergences and consist of a powerful blend of mass protest and popular education. They've been widely used to organize against economic summits and other events that advance the cause of global capitalism. Yet convergences face unique challenges. Next month, there's going to be an anti-Olympic convergence taking place in Vancouver. According to Jane Kirby, it will not be exempt from such challenges, but may stand to make gains for the movements that participate in it. Jane Kirby is a freelance journalist and author of the article Mass Protests and the Future of Convergence Activism. That article appeared in this month's Briarpatch magazine, and she joins us from Halifax. Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Now, before we turn to this February's anti-Olympic convergence, let's talk about the history of this tactic. What made Seattle and subsequent global justice convergences different from past mass demonstrations?
Well, I think maybe it wasn't so much that they were all that different, but it was certainly a new wave of convergences, I think. I think the idea of having mass protests was sort of dead for a few years, basically, but also that it brought together people from around the world and also people from very different sectors protesting together. And I think that was maybe a little bit different than previous demonstrations, being united as everybody was against globalization. You were seeing anarchists and environmentalists and church groups coming together and engaging in actions together, often very different actions and often diverse actions, but ultimately with similar goals. So that, I think, is a pretty significant difference.
What kind of gains can movements generally make by using this approach?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's a highly contested and debated question. I think recently there's been a lot of calling into question of the usefulness of convergences, particularly after 9/11, when we were seeing, an increase in the criminalization of mass movements, and convergences would be accompanied a lot of the times with, mass arrests, and people often didn't really see what was being gained. You know, we were getting people arrested and fighting legal battles, but what concretely was being achieved was often lost. And also the convergences, because basically groups of people would follow these convergences around a lot of the time. So people would be hopping from city to city following, the WTO, the World Bank, the IMF, following the train of convergences around in demonstrations. So often the convergences themselves and the people demonstrating were not necessarily strongly connected to the local communities in which the convergences were taking place. So in a lot of ways, the organizing around the convergences really distracted from kind of ongoing, really local organizing that did have the ability to make concrete gains. So I think for those reasons, in recent years, activists have been shying away from the convergence tactic and looking for new ways to either use the convergence tactic or shying away from it completely.
I guess also there is a certain class issue in that if you can afford to travel to different places, then you are maybe of a different class than the people whose city that you are going to.
Absolutely. Class and race also being a really significant thing. The face of the anti-globalization movement in the North, and in the North meaning North America and Europe, has been predominantly white, and recognizing that within our own countries it's migrants, it's people of color, it's indigenous people who are facing the brunt of globalizations as well as other kinds of domination, facing the brunt of their ills, basically. Having them being excluded from movements is in a lot of ways only replicating pretty racist, as well as, you mentioned, classist sort of dynamics within movements.
Has there been criticism from local communities and people who were doing local organizing of the tactic of convergences when it comes to their particular area?
I think there has been. I can't point to any specific examples offhand, but certainly I think there have been definite criticisms of people saying that, you know, people are swooping into town, like doing these protests, not having any idea often what the local issues are, and how they might be connected to a broader, like the broader globalization phenomena, and yeah, you know, oftentimes convergences you see like heavy state presence, heavy police presence. In fact, I shouldn't say oftentimes; I should say all the time. And having those come into communities that are not actually don't have a strong participation within the protests or within the convergence, it's pretty problematic for the rest of the community, and you can see how it would actually isolate activists from maybe the more general population which they're trying to reach.
Now, in the article, you discuss how organizing this anti-Olympic convergence next month is already different from past convergence organizing. What's unique about it?
Well, I think one of the really, and in my opinion, the most significant departure, and I think many activists who are directly involved share this opinion from speaking with them, the most significant departure is the fact that an anti-colonial stance is being put right at the center of organizing. And I think that has changed to a large extent. It shifted the race dynamics of the people organizing so that there is a significant number of people of color and a significant number of indigenous people directly involved in the organizing and leading the organizing, in fact, which is a pretty significant shift. Most of the organizing is being done under the banner of No Olympics on Stolen Native Land, and I think that's huge. That's huge because it's putting anti-colonialism right at the center of the protest. It's not just one of the issues. It's really the issue that's being said. We have to look at this first before we can address anything else. This is like a major kind of root issue that is just as important as being anti-capitalist, for example.
Let's talk about some of the challenges that this convergence might face. I mean, you've identified some barriers in your article that people of color and indigenous peoples face to participating. Could you lay those out for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly we can think of, for example, migrant people who don't have status. They face a lot more risk being out in the streets where there's a heavy security and a heavy police presence. It's like we're basically seeing, you know, in a lot of ways, unprecedented security measures being put in place to deal with protests during the Games. So certainly, you know, the migrant workers who have been called in to build Olympic infrastructure are not going to be able to participate. And likewise, indigenous people, we know, tend to be criminalized more easily. People of color tend to be criminalized more easily. So they have a lot more to lose by being out on the streets, and particularly given the really gigantic security budgets that we're seeing in the lead-up to the Olympics.
Are there victories in that movements here will not be able to win, in your opinion?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, I think there's limitations at this point to any mass protest. And I mean, the anti-Olympics organizers face a really significant challenge, and a challenge that I don't think actually did exist in the same way with other convergences associated with the anti-globalization movement. And that is that people, like a general population, really love the Olympics. So it makes it a lot harder to criticize and a lot harder in many ways to gain mass support than protesting the WTO, which, you know, many people don't know what the WTO is, but they maybe don't have the same sort of emotional attachment to it that they do the Olympics. So I think there's that barrier, but I think that's one of the reasons why resistance to the Olympics has been very localized in Vancouver, and I think that's a benefit, ultimately. So that's a gain for the movement, the fact that the people who are being involved are the people who are being directly affected by the Olympics, and that's the reason in a lot of cases that they're involved, not necessarily because they have a strong political motivation. It's because the Olympics is disrupting their lives. So I think there's a very different dynamic there.
Well, I have to say, love of the Olympics is in short supply in this local area at the moment.
Which is great to hear. It's really great to hear. But, I mean, you know, being, I've been at the disruptions of the torch relay in Halifax and Toronto, and you'll have people booing, you know, because people really love the Olympics. You'll have people booing the protesters. And just like a really strong misunderstanding of what it is that's being protested. And people do have this real emotional attachment. So I think that that's a huge challenge that anti-Olympics organizers have had to face. I mean, I think given the circumstances, they've been fairly successful in getting their message across the country. But I think it's a challenge that maybe wasn't there with the anti-globalization movement.
Well, what kind of victories do you think can be achieved by this convergence?
Well, I think the biggest victories will be the energy that it's injected into ongoing organizing in Vancouver, because it has been groups largely that have already been organizing around different issues, around poverty issues, around civil liberties issues, around Indigenous issues, migrant issues, etc., that have come together to organize around the Olympics. So I think there's a lot of links that have been made between groups, from what I understand, a lot of really interesting conversations about how those groups can work together. And it's just injected a lot of energy and kind of a sense of urgency around a lot of this organizing, and maybe tied in some of the day-to-day work into bigger issues of capitalism, bigger issues of colonialism, which I think can only serve to strengthen movements in Vancouver. And I think, again, as you mentioned, the local population really seeing the Olympics and really seeing the effects of the Olympics, it has the potential to really educate people about some of the systems of domination that they're facing with the Games, and really, really use the fact that people are being locally affected as an educational tool. The other thing is that because the Olympics are so dependent on media, dependent on tourism, you can't do the same thing that you've done with... an activist mentioned this to me, and I thought it was a really excellent point, that you can't move the Olympics out of the reach of protesters like you can with a WTO summit, put it in ever more remote locations that are more and more difficult for people to get to so that people can't shut it down. You can't do that with the Olympics in the same way because it is so dependent on the tourism industry. So you need to be able, you need it to be accessible to people to get there. Otherwise, it destroys a lot of the benefits for developers and a lot of the benefits for the tourism industries, which is, you know, one of the main motivations behind the Olympics. So I think by disrupting that, there's a significant gain to be made there for future host cities and making it more difficult for the IOC to operate.
One of the things that I have noticed here is that people are becoming very aware of what it's like to live in a situation where you're in conflict with security, in conflict with the police. They're trying to stop you doing what you want to do, and that must needs build a bridge with more marginalized people and First Nations people who experience that on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. I think it can only build a sense of solidarity and hopefully an understanding that that is what people are experiencing on a day-to-day basis, what you will only experience in exceptional circumstances as a person who's not of color or not a visible minority.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us this morning, Jane.
Thanks very much. It was good to speak to you.
Good to speak to you, too. We've been speaking with freelance journalist Jane Kirby. She wrote the article Mass Protests and the Future of Convergence Activism that appears in this month's Briar Patch magazine. And you can read Briar Patch. It's briarpatchmagazine.com. If you want more information on the anti-Olympic convergence, you can go to olympicresistance.net.